Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
Welcome to episode 279 of the Barcelona Podcast, brought to you by the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Dan Hilton, and with me again today is Emil Evanesian. How's it going, Emil?
I'm good, Dan. Probably a little bit better than in recent weeks. You know, we've got some positivity to just beam over, so that's fantastic.
Yeah, today it's good moods only, or at least good moods until the very last part of the show where we have to talk to finances. So it's generally good moods only here on the show, on the podcast today. And we're talking all about the 4-2 win to kick off the La Liga campaign. And Emil, I thought we could set the scene a bit, then go back and forth with our headlines, if you will. Sure. A little bit of what Francesca and I did, even this is for the old school fans. We're talking 27, we're talking 3-4 years old school fans will know La Bolsa. So I thought we'd maybe do a little bit of La Bolsa. And that, I know La Bolsa is stock up, stock down, but it's kind of like the headlines of players that we thought were basically impressive. So all these stocks in this case of La Bolsa are all going up. So before we get too far, the three stats are from friend of the show, Adil at Barca19 Stats on Twitter. I ripped that from him. So he is worth the follow. I do give him credit, give him the follow on Twitter. So the last time that Real Sociedad got a point at the Camp Nou, I had said it all over Twitch and in the locker room and all that for the Barcelona Twitch channel, it was 1995. Koeman and Imanol, the manager of Real Sociedad, were both players at the time. They last got a point. So there was a sense that, you know, maybe with the faces being the same, that it would happen again. But no, it was not. It was not meant to be, because Real Sociedad lost all of their first 23 away La Liga games against Barca from 1929 to 1961. So that was an interesting stat to me as well, that they had not won a game at, it wasn't just the Camp Nou, it was like Court. It was wherever Barca had been playing from 1929 when the Liga started to 1961, they had never won. And then Real Sociedad had lost all of their last 23 away league matches against Barca from 1996 to 2020. And that now includes the 21. So now the streak is a new one, if you will, at 20.
Oh, that's wild.
Really interesting that Real Sociedad started for, what is that, 32 years being terrible at Barcelona's home. And now recently they've been terrible. And you know, we think of Real Sociedad as a much better team than that because of how good they are at home.
And I mean, I think of them just generally just kind of, you know, as a lower half of the top 10 side. Typically you're never going to see them in a relegation fight. And, you know, kind of like on those odd years when things kind of work out well, you know, you can see them kind of pushing for Europa League or something like that. But yeah, I mean, that's a wild run. It kind of makes me wonder. I mean, I wonder if they've been awful against Espanyol too. Is there just something about arriving in Barcelona that, you know, that just doesn't jive with these guys? But that's crazy. Actually, interestingly, the first two matches I ever went to at Camp Nou were home games against Real Sociedad. And so it's actually good to know. I mean, that's good value if you want to ensure seeing a Barca win.
Yeah, I mean, I say those things, but the players don't care. Every single game is different to them. The other magic was five. And I think it's a little bit of a talking point, as in five of the 22 players starting for Barca and Real Sociedad, they also started for Spain in the Olympic gold medal game that happened just 9 days ago. So that being Eric Garcia, Pedri for Barcelona, and then Zubimendi, Mikel Moreno, and Orizabal. And Orizabal had also, along with Garcia and Pedri, had played in the Euros. So three players had played in the Euros straight to the Olympics, and then Zubimendi and Marino also started in that Olympics gold medal final.
Yeah.
Over a week ago. So that tells you that both of these clubs are very reliant on their young players, with the Olympics being 23. So on their young players, and along with Eric Garcia also making debuts, were Emerson, Nico Gonzalez, off those two off the bench. And Memphis obviously made his official Barcelona debut yesterday as well. So yeah, I mean, does it surprise you about not the rest thing, but I know we keep talking about Pedri, but it seems like all teams that are relying on young talent who are at the Olympics or at Euros are kind of just playing through it.
I mean, particularly the fact that Pedri's played in both of the summer tournaments, and, you know, one of them was in Japan, you know, so it's, he's traveled all over, you know, first all over Europe, then all over the world. And it really is kind of interesting to me. I understand he's young, he's fit, and, you know, I mean, I guess you can kind of rely on the tropes of young and boundless energy and everything like that. But I mean, you have to figure at some point, this guy's just got to be tired, right? I mean, just, I mean, it obviously speaks to what Koeman feels his sort of the depth situation is in the midfield, where, I mean, ideally you'd like to give Pedri at least, you know, maybe the first couple matches of the season off, just let him get reacclimated and just, you know, sort of lick his wounds and recharge his batteries a little bit. But the fact that we're not even doing that, you know, I mean, I think Koeman very much has a sense of, I think this three is his midfield three, as you know, when all of them are upright and able to play, barring any suspensions or injuries. And I mean, I think he's very much just going to stick with that. And, you know, it'd be nice to sort of to dabble a little bit. And, you know, maybe he wanted to give him the home opener and maybe rest him against Athletic Bilbao next week. We don't know. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit, I don't know, problematic is the right word, but I would like to see him get a little bit of rest and not just sort of just, you know, wear the tread on the tires all the way down.
I think on the case of Pedri and his rest and the depth, it's telling that it's a shame for the people who were out crying for Ricky Puig to get minutes, because it wasn't about Puig so much yesterday as it was that there is worry that there's a lack of trust and depth in the midfield. And when you do have Puig sitting there, who seems to be able to complement many of the things that Pedri does. And I don't think anyone's arguing the fact that Pedri is a better player than Ricky Puig. Just a matter of that for Pedri, even in the short term, as I've said before, he might actually not be tired. He might not actually need rest because he's 18 and recovers very, very, very quickly. But just like Ansu Fati, all of these young players, if they get one injury, it chops years off the end of their career. And so we might see Pedri, and the example I keep seeing is Cesc Fabregas, because Cesc Fabregas, when he was 31 playing for Chelsea, he fell off a cliff. Yep. And now he's what, still 34, floating around Monaco, I believe. But yeah, he just, with all the minutes he had played, he debuted for Arsenal at what, 15 or 16?
I think he was 16. Yeah, something like that.
Just
yeah.
Straight through all the way Arsenal, all the way King Captain to Barcelona. And that just burned him out. And so I do find some comparisons. I know people won't be happy because they remember Cesc Fabregas at Barca, but he was a very, very, very good player for Arsenal, and he was a good player for Barca too. That's where I see the parallels in terms of that, just overloading a young player in that way. And it hurts them at the end of the career. And just like how Barca isn't worried about their finances under Bartomeu, they weren't worried about finances in the short term, rather in the long term, they only cared about the short term. The same thing's happening here with Pedri and his career, where we're, you know, very concerned with success in the short term. So not even burn him out, not even get him rest, but he's recovering fine because he's 18 years old. But these miles are going to add up. There are certain thresholds in sports that when players play X number of first league or professional minutes, then they start to struggle. And that's what you're going to see. So I would say, you know, put a pin in the Pedri stuff. I hope he gets rest sometime. But yes, if he continues to be, you know, ground down like this, like we saw Fabregas at Arsenal, then you're going to have issues in quite a few years. And then for the rest of those young players too, it's the same thing, that we have modern technology that's going to be able to, you know, guide them through these times, get them rest, get them rotation. And on the point of Puig, it's not about trying to find reasons as to why we need to agree with Koeman as to why he did not play, but it's rather that when push comes to shove, Ronald Koeman is trying to balance the fact that Barcelona desperately needed a victory. So he had to put only players that he unequivocally trusted on the field. And it seems like for another year, as he stated almost the last summer, he stated before he began really the job that he didn't truly trust Ricky Puig. And that hasn't truly, truly changed. Now, I've said I thought he'd have a role, and I'm not going to eat crow just yet, Emil. As you know, you know, I said that it was a certain minutes at the end of the season. It was a certain appearances at the end of the year. That was a threshold, but we're not off to a good start. It's 0-1, and it's not about Pooch's success. As I said, it's just about finding minutes for everybody. And yes, it is worrying that he was not willing to put, yes, Roberto came on, but the De Jong, Roberto, Busquets midfield is, I don't think, one that Ronald Koeman is particularly happy to see. But okay, but we're kind of off the beaten path. Let's do La Bolsa. Let's do the headlines. Emil, what's your first headline for me?
So, I mean, my first one is, I mean, I don't know if I have a snappy headline for it, but I think it's about Martin Braithwaite and how it's, isn't it funny how when some of the rumors die down for a minute and all the chatter isn't about how you're expendable and you're not good enough for your job and you need to be shipped out, you know, like you can just go out and play a really good game. You know, I mean, he was a good striker. Like he played fantastically yesterday. And, you know, again, it's, I realize we have all these small sample sizes and there's going to be temptations to kind of overreact and get a little giddy about the things that go super well. But he played yesterday with a lot of energy. He was in the right place, you know, at the right time. And he was aggressive, but he was also, you know, kind of, he was distributing the ball. He played an excellent game. I mean, he played, you know, there was other crosses that he played in, you know, in addition to the one that got the fourth goal, that, you know, there was a couple where just nobody was home, you know, no one made the runs, but the ball was just, you know, right in that danger area. So, I mean, he looked very, very encouraging for my money.
The fluidity of that front three was something that I said I was excited for and something that, looking at the heat maps, did come to fruition. And Martin Braithwaite was a part of that. We were reminded that he can play on the wing. He did well for Denmark on the wing. And his heat map said that he wasn't even a traditional number nine, that he was on the left, on the right at times in buildup. And it is telling, though, that Martin Braithwaite started, because I think Ronald Koeman also reinforcing this idea is that by giving Ray Menage a spot in the squad in the number 14 shirt, it does indicate to you that A, Sergio Aguero might never be healthy and might even be gone in January. That's one. Yeah. But two, that Ronald Koeman does want a number nine. He does want some kind of striker, some kind of poacher, some kind of player up there. Not even because Martin Braithwaite is, again, a guy that's going to hold the ball up, because I think Memphis and Griezmann actually hold the ball up better. And they actually are the ones who make runs off of those hold up play a bit better than Braithwaite even. But he wants to have someone up top, in theory, to be a number nine, to be a poacher, just to put the ball in the back of the net. Because of all the chances that Barca, even without Messi, all the chances that Barcelona will create. And so we'll see if that changes when Fati comes back and kind of does muddy that a little bit with the top level talent. But I think that Barca are hedging their bets about Braithwaite. And we'll look, and we'll see what happens with returns, because I think Barca might know more about his future or his next few weeks and months and season than we do health wise. So there might be something that, again, I don't want to get all gloom and doom on it, but
no, exactly. But I mean, but it makes sense. I mean, look, all we've seen kind of setbacks, or, you know, not a quick bounce back. And, you know, it hasn't been a sort of a steady stream of sort of optimistic and encouraging news. Not that it's been necessarily discouraging, but, you know, what we've heard is usually along the lines of, well, it's going to be a little bit more time, rather than his comeback is right around the corner. So I think it's fair to kind of at least operate, you know, kind of reasonably operate in the situation that you've been given.
Yeah, and I saw that people were saying that it's an unpopular opinion that Barcelona should continue to still be shopping Braithwaite, even though he had two goals. He becomes the first player, or first Danish player, let me very much correct that, first Danish player to score 2+ goals in a Liga game since Michael Laudrup did it, unfortunately, for Real Madrid back in 1996. Okay. Yeah, I mean, there's not that many Danish players, so it's not that crazy of a stat. Yeah. Anyway, the point is Martin Braithwaite starts the year with a brace. I don't think anybody had that a few weeks ago, that start the season not always starting. But, you know, the unpopular opinion seems to be that a Braithwaite should still be sold. And I completely agree with that. And I don't think that's unpopular. That, as I said earlier in the, or last week, that Neto, because he's a first string goalkeeper who's going to have to be a backup again, and Braithwaite, because he's going to guarantee you between 8 and 13 goals, depending on the team and your reliance on him. And there was a third one who now I'm forgetting, but either way, those two in particular, at the top of the attack and then the goalkeeping position, they're two. Oh, Lenglet was a third one.
Yeah.
Because Lenglet is a, I mean, I think a starting center back at most clubs. Is he elite level? Is he Champions League starting? No, I don't think he is. I don't think he fits the system at Barcelona. We'll get to some of the center backs that do fit that system. But Lenglet would be the third one that if I'm Barcelona, their financial, as we'll talk about at the end, their financial picture has not changed. They're still in trouble. And those are the three that I think are not untouchable, like Pedri. And we're not talking any player under 24. Those are the players who are in that window where I think they're worth something. And I would continue to feel calls for Brathwaite, Neto, and Lenglet, especially after what we've seen in the, not necessarily Lenglet, but what we've seen from Neto and Brathwaite. They should be worth even more after the last 2-3 weeks because they've been really good. So you sell high. You have to sell high on those players. I don't think that's unpopular at all. And Barcelona just have to survive and just take that money.
No, the one thing that I think is that I'd be tempted to hang on to, I mean, barring a really good offer, barring a sizable offer, I'd be tempted to hold on to Brathwaite until the January window because I think it's like we were talking about with, we don't know where Ansu Fati is at exactly. And, you and I were talking offline, like it still seems not 100% sorted out where Antoine Griezmann, what exactly his role is and where he fits in and how much of that is actually going to be goal scoring and how much of it is based on his kind of his work rate and his distribution and hold up play. So I think Brathwaite might just almost out of necessity get a lot of opportunities to essentially be the number nine and just stuff in a bunch of goals. And that half season could do a lot to bolster his value. So, I mean, I think there might even be a slightly better sell high opportunity in January if he's coming off of a sort of a really torrid start to the season.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Right. I mean, I spoke about how deep that forward line is supposed to be, and it is. And now counting Ray Minaj, and I call for Youssef Demir to start, and Martin Brathwaite is the first team player in that instance. Again, Youssef Demir, even with Messi gone, you thought that his role might change a lot, but it still could be that the club is going to say, hey, you're still 18. We still don't want to push you into the first team before you're ready. We're going to leave you with Barca B. And I said the same thing about Balde and Gabi. I think they're still, when Barca B begins official play in 2 or 3 weeks, they'll still be mainstays in the B team. And then they'll impress, they'll earn their opportunities in potentially the spring for FC Barcelona, the first team. So if Demir's still on that path, again, keeping Brathwaite doesn't lose anything. And then with Ray Minaj, now it seems like for Barca B, he was never in the picture anyway. He was going to be sold. And now Barca just holding on to him because they want players who are going to put the ball in the back of the net. Yep. You lose 38 goals from Lionel Messi in the Liga. Memphis is going to make up for, we'll say, hopefully a large portion of that. Ansu Fati returning should make up for a portion of that. But, it's easy for me to get to those 38 goals if things go well and if players do what they're supposed to. And I was saying that as I transitioned to my first headline about Gerard Piqué. Last year, he had two goals. Usually he has around 4 to 5. And Piqué to get that first goal, it's not so much about hitting that La Liga numbers goal scored quota, but for me, it's the fact that Gerard Piqué, I don't often because I look so much at stats and try to be analytical and try to just, you know, not overblow any particular thing of the heart. It was telling. And I think we should lean into that Gerard Piqué is the heart and soul of this team with Messi gone. And I know he's a bit goofy. He talked about the selfies. He's the fact that he was not only willing to take the pay cut, and I think some of it was good PR for him that he took that pay cut at a time when, like, perfectly timing it, that Memphis and Eric Garcia and Emerson could be, or rather Raymond Hodge could be registered. Yeah, it's the way you want to draw up a narrative that it was the first match without Messi, his class of 1987 teammate. You know, with now Messi gone, it was all about Gerard Piqué saying, hey, Kool-Aid, you're hurting, I'm hurting. And for me, it really is. We vicariously live through these players. And for PK to say, hey, this was my friend. You think you're heartbroken? You're, you know, fan around the world. I'm heartbroken. That was my guy. That was my friend. That was a guy I've known since I was 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
And, or sorry.
I was 12 or 13 or something. Yeah.
Came over from Argentina. So, I mean, that's my guy. And we're heartbroken. We didn't expect this either. But we will carry on. We will be okay. And he's not going to score every goal, but for him to get that first goal, a weight was lifted off everybody. Memphis Depay was able to make his debut quite freely. And I think it's really telling that Memphis also was the one who delivered the free kick, the guy that that was registered because Piqué took the pay cut. So there was some kind of narrative enjoyment I got out of it, that sometimes we have to make it bigger than the football because all the finances and everything, those are bigger than football. So sometimes the storybook part of it also has to be enjoyable. And I want to actually for a moment just relish in that emotion, because we've all been sad. We've all been heartbroken, but PK kind of gave us something to celebrate. They gave us some kind of hope. And that's really what we want to hang on to.
You said it. I mean, that was just watching that game yesterday. It was kind of, I mean, I was telling my wife that yesterday's game was sort of an enjoyable, free-flowing, goals are flowing Barcelona game that I don't feel like I've seen in a while. It just, and I think towards the end of last season, there was kind of the ill-fated push for the title that never came to fruition and this and that, but it always felt like there was some sort of, I don't know, impending issue or some sort of stressor or some sort of black cloud or, you know, that was kind of hanging over the team. And there wasn't a lot of like unbridled fun. Now, granted, there's still kind of there's a lot of impending issues with the finances and this and that and whatever. There's a lot of kind of nonsense, you know, around the club. But at the same time, I feel like it's just gotten so bad that like it's all the dirty laundry is out there now. So you could almost sort of innocently enjoy the just basking in this game. And that for Gerard Piqué to score the first goal. And yeah, I mean, for like you said, for Memphis, who's, I mean, it's not crazy to say, I mean, he's the best addition to the team, you know, from this summer. And on top of that, he's sort of the notional Messi replacement. And so it was nice that there wasn't kind of a barren patch where he starts getting frustrated and pressing, or, you know, fans start getting annoyed and, you know, whatever. Just no, right off the bat, first 20 minutes or whatever it was, he inch perfect cross, and Gerard Piqué, sort of future president Piqué, just buries it. And it just for that moment, it just kind of felt like everything was okay. And so it was, yeah, it was good. It was all, I mean, I do watch sports more. I mean, I'm very analytical. I like the stats and everything like that. But when I watch very much just with my heart on my sleeve. And that was what needed to happen. Like that was inch perfect.
Yeah. Then he goes on Twitch after the match, calls Arnaut Tanasa next Victor Valdez, which, you know, making me look smart because I've said Arnaut Tanasa, no offense to Iñaki Peña, but I put my faith in Arnaut Tanasa in the future. He's a little bit undersized, but I mean, he's got that thing that you want your goalkeeper to have. I don't know what it is. It's just that extra bit of something. He's a little bit crazy, just like Victor Valdez. And then on the point of the selfies, he says, everyone asked me about the selfies. He said he was bored, but then he said the whole Instagram selfies thing is a joke. A teammate the other day told me something about engagements and I decided to try it out. It's nothing more than that. I saw some reports about some other motive, but no, it's just a joke. And, you know, I think it's interesting because we feel like it's like a midlife crisis that we're watching Gerard Piqué go through with these selfies. But I also think he's just an incredibly silly guy. There was the locker room. Someday we go back to his partnership with Puyol, that they were foils, that he and Alves and the prankster were silly. And there was Puyol and there was other hard nosed guys in there. And even Piqué along that back line. Now, I mean, I'm going to wait on my next headline. So I want to hear your next one. Then I think we all know what direction I'm going.
Okay, so I sort of alluded to this, and I want to get your thoughts on it. Sort of the, I guess for a moment, I'm going to downshift with the giddiness and joy, but more into neutral, not so much negative. But where do you see Antoine Griezmann sort of fitting in here? Because I think I know what we know what we think he's supposed to be. We know what he was at his apex with Atletico Madrid, and you know, so much of the story when he first arrived at Barcelona was, you know, can he play with Messi? And there was, you know, all these sort of, you know, the wicked whispers type stuff. And, you know, these two can't play together. And then they'd have to publicly declare that they could and all of this. So now I feel like with all of that, Griezmann never sort of found whatever his niche was and found wherever his groove was going to be. It does seem like, I think we kind of touched on this recently too. I think it might have been the last week. It feels like Memphis has come in with a clearer sense right from the jump of what his role is going to be and how he's planning on attacking his role at Barcelona. And I still don't know what Antoine Griezmann is and how he's best utilized on this team.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I try to answer that question myself, because I did the same thing, was again, looking at those heat maps for the front three and seeing where Antoine Griezmann's position was. And it was telling to me that there seemed to be this, not as every player kind of created these little Venn diagrams or pockets of space on the field. It was really telling that there was this place about at midfield, just a bit to the right of center, where Busquets, De Jong, and not Sergino Dest, because he was way out to the wing, but where Busquets, De Jong, and Griezmann kind of all converged. There, Braithwaite really wasn't in that space often. Pedri was kind of still on the left. But there was this little pocket where Griezmann would continue to look for 1-2s with De Jong. He would look to set up that crossfield ball. And I think looking at the performance of Frankie De Jong, I mean, he on paper was, I think, the man of the match. I know there was not on paper. Sorry. I think advanced metrics say he was a man of the match. As good as Braithwaite was, he got the two results with the 2 goals and the 1 assist. And my obviously next headline, I already gave it away, is going to be Eric Garcia. But I thought Eric Garcia was great. Piqué was cool, and he was also good in the match. But Frank de Jong, 71 minutes played, 1 assist, 40 touches, 31 of 31 on accurate passes, 3 key passes. That is an important one there.
Yep.
2 big chances created, 1 long ball, 2 for 2 on successful dribbles, 1 interception, 5 duels won, 2 tackles, and 5 recoveries. De Jong was ever on the field. And of course, a lot of it is credit to his work rate. But Griezmann is going to have to operate partially in the space that Messi is vacating. But he's also going to have to continue to drag defenders so that Sergino Dest and Frankie de Jong can now exploit that right side. So there's something about losing Messi. Obviously, it was the space that we always talked about that in kind of the abstract about how when we watched Coutinho, I couldn't point it out. I couldn't draw it on a map for you. But Coutinho was going to get in the way of Messi. We knew that was going to be the case. That was my fear about Griezmann, that he was going to try to operate in the same space as Messi. That was a worry. Because Memphis comes in on the left, it was less of a worry, you know, when we were talking about him coming in. But now with Messi vacating that space, it seems like to me that Griezmann is going to work hard to try to pull one of those, either the outside back, or if you're going to play a double pivot, that being the opposition, he's going to always want to try to occupy that other defensive midfielder. And that's going to free up De Jong to get much more dribbly, where we want him to, you know, we always think of him in his best in Ajax, where he picks it up as this almost a third center back, as a libero. And then he guides it 40 yards by dribbling around these traffic cones. But really where his dribbles are going to come in play this year is working off Griezmann, with Dest always contending that fullback out wide. And then De Jong is going to find those spaces, not in the half space, but a little bit more inside that flank on that channel, in that kind of in that inside space, not on the touchline. And that's where he's going to get his dribbles. That's where he's going to find his space and his success. And that comes because of Griezmann. Griezmann had his 2 chances in the game. One would have been a scorpion kick that would have blown our eyes out. Be awesome. But, you know, he's going to get his goals. Occasionally, they're going to come out of nothing. He's not going to get a lot of big chances, if you will. He also has to convert better than he did last year. He missed a lot of chances last season, which I think he will finally hit home, because he knows that more are coming, as opposed to Messi taking all of them. I think he knows that more are going to come to his feet. But I think because he brought so much out of De Jong, my point is really more about De Jong than it is Griezmann. But we have to continue to, and I have to continue to think of football, not as just this player played really well, because players can play great on their own, but also how does Griezmann, who's the ultimate system player, how does he enhance his teammates? And I thought he did a superb job yesterday of enhancing Memphis, Brathwaite, and De Jong. And that's why they were probably three of the top four players in the game.
Sure. And that's actually that's a reasonable point. I mean, I've been, it's not that I'm fully out on Griezmann, but I think it's kind of sort of the stuff that we were talking about, the needing to convert chances and things like that have been sort of more front and center in my head. And yeah, so, I mean, I do see some of the value that you're talking about. I mean, I think it's, yeah, like I guess if this is sort of the long-term game plan, then I think, you know, like you're saying, if it can be executed that way and, you know, Griezmann's not in the way of either the midfielders or the other attackers, but is kind of able to play a nuanced style that sort of complements them both, then yeah, I mean, I do think there's a lot of value there. I mean, I just, but that's kind of been my concern just in watching him. I mean, it was from last year. I mean, this season is brand new, and I mean, shoot, it was hard to be mad at anybody after, you know, after that game yesterday, but it was just kind of it's been my lingering sort of question and concern with him.
But I mean, do you think we downplay his defensive? I mean, yeah, do we downplay his defensive acumen? Like, I saw that there were people tweeting out or people saying that after the two goals came in, and those like that 3 minute stretch where Barcelona, they dominated the entire match, they turned off for 3 minutes, two La Real goals are scored. But his work rate, it's almost become a trope now that it's like hard work, and we don't really contextualize what that is. And people can just say, oh, the defense is terrible, and you just pin it on center backs or whatever. But Antoine Griezmann works so hard. And I was really happy to see how hard Memphis works as well. They work cohesively a unit where in the first 18 minutes of that match, Real Sociedad had completed 16 passes. And that is a compliment to all 11 players on the field.
Crazy,
right? All of the players deserve credit for closing down that space. And I know people are like, oh, they scored the two goals, but don't look at those two goals. That's a team where Koeman has to say to his team, hey, you guys turned off for 3 minutes and that game got interesting, but Barcelona were in second gear at that point and they didn't want to get hurt and they had done their job already. So
and
I'm not too terrible
for being not at all. Yeah, I agree. Because I mean, if we're being honest, the first goal, maybe they turned off a little bit. And honestly, it was a beautiful goal. I mean, the through ball to set it up and everything was just it was a fantastic goal. And I mean the second one, the Oyarzabal
free kick.
I mean, I mean, the guy put a laser in the top corner. I mean, it's just, you know, sometimes you just have to tip your cap and just, you know, he was far out. Like, you typically don't worry too much when like a non-Messi player has a free kick that far away from goal. So, I mean, if they're going to make that, you just sort of tip your cap and, you know, sort of move on. But yeah, I agree. I mean, I do think there was maybe a little bit of turnoff for the first goal. And I mean, the second one was just spectacular effort. But so I agree with that. But I think defensively, I do think there's a little bit of a trope, or we've almost, it's become sort of a catchphrase. Like, it's become part of Antoine Griezmann's name, Antoine Griezmann, he of the work rate. And just, but we do kind of gloss over the miles and miles of running and kind of the, you know, you have to chase these lost causes and, you know, just kind of keep doing the work. And he does do a lot of thankless work without sort of making a big deal about it or sort of being a prima donna about it after the fact. So, I mean, in that sense, I do think he provides a lot of value in that sense. I mean, I think sometimes it's just difficult to reconcile sort of because you also want him to score goals. You know what I mean? It's because these are all these kind of ancillary things we're talking about, because if he scores 6 goals this season or 9 goals this season, but you know, we're not going to be nearly as impressed with the defensive work rate and, you know, and the effort, because we'll be saying at the very least, like, okay, like you should at least be doing that. But ultimately, like, you got to put the ball in the net. And that's where I'm starting to have a little bit of concern with him. But I mean, it's not alarm bells or anything like that. Like, he's
no, but I think that's a fair concern, because I think you're right that Antoine Griezmann is the one player on the team, because we go back to his price, his price tag. And because he, I mean, Coutinho will get so much of this ire, but you're right that because he was such an important part of how they were playing yesterday, we can give him compliments on the fact that those moves, if you will, or those progressions ended with Martin Brathwaite scoring two and Gerard Pique got his one on the free kick and De Jong played really, really well. But when it's Champions League time and the bright lights are on and it's a knockout game, there, that being De Jong and Brathwaite and Pique are not going to be blamed for not putting the ball in the back of the net. Because again, Brathwaite, we're not expecting for him to be the quality to put it in the back of the net in the a Champions League knockout round, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's going to come down to Antoine Griezmann, right? And those are the nights when, in the same thing we did the last few seasons with Luis Suarez, especially on the road, that you said, Luis Suarez, you're the number nine. Like, you're the guy who's, we're paying you to score goals. Like, you're the guy to score goals. And so the ire came on him. And on the times that Messi didn't score the goals, we always look back and say, hey, he scored a lot of Champions League goals. He was always the hero. But on the time that he didn't come up, certainly the rest of the world was saying, hey, Messi, once again, in this instance, kind of choked in this big moment. And so you're right that when Barca is winning and crushing teams in the Liga, we give compliments to Griezmann, his work rate, and how he fits into that system. But when the Champions League, because of the fanfare and because the global audience is watching, it becomes about the individuals. And the individuals are to blame. And the individuals then also get the credit. So it's going to come time. You're right. When the matches get big and the lights get brightest, if Memphis and Griezmann wilt, that is when the ire is really going to come down upon them. Absolutely. Yeah. I completely agree about the Griezmann point. And it's all about how we shape the narrative around him. Yeah. And another narrative that my other headline here, Eric Garcia, it's one match in. It's funny. I mean, you and I have talked about this before. I don't argue on Twitter. I kind of keep to myself and I take notes. I take tabs and people don't even argue with me. It's me with a straw man, but this man is somebody who, I mean, there was so much Eric Garcia hate beforehand. We as Kool-Aid's got gassed by Man City fans into saying that he was washed up and he was 20 years old and he just wasn't fast. He didn't have it. He just, his understanding of the game, he was just behind it defensively. And yeah, he passed the ball and that's great. And isn't it nice that a guy can play with the ball at his feet? But a lot of players can do that. But he does that at an elite rate. His ball playing is elite. And then his defensive awareness is, as much as he cannot win in a full sprint against a lot of players, his defensive awareness and his positioning.
His positioning is good.
Can I read the stats or I'll give you your thoughts.
Do it. Yeah. No, go for it.
But
no, I mean, I think what I do like about him is, and there's a certain kind of breed of basketball player that kind of fits into this, is sort of the guy that doesn't necessarily, none of his measurables sort of jump off the screen at you. Like he's not the most powerful guy. Like he's not the fastest. He doesn't jump the highest or, you know, anything, but it's just having a knack for understanding sort of where to drift to, and whether it's having a nose for the ball or having a nose for where the opposition is going to go.
You know what vibes I'm getting? NBA. Yeah. I'm getting like 2008, 2009 Rajon Rondo vibes. I'm not a big Rondo fan, and I'm kind of down on the Celtics, but yeah, I'm getting like early Rajon Rondo, young in that Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen.
Yeah.
You know, just being that complimentary piece as well. But could he shoot? Never. But play defense. Was he always in the right spot? Was he always making the right decisions? So
he was super smart. Yeah. Like he thinks the game and he understands the game in a way where he doesn't have to sprint as often because he's kind of drifted to the right place 3 seconds or 5 seconds earlier. So he doesn't have to sort of bust a gut to make up that turf because he took a couple of strides to his left or to his right, sort of when no one was paying attention.
Yeah, and I'm going to use hyperbole here. The partnership between Eric Garcia and Gerard Pique is good, but the partnership that we saw at the Euros between Garcia and Sergio Busquets, I think is great. I really enjoy the fact that those two, I know it's two players you think on paper are slow, they positionally best out of each other. And we go all the way back to the days of Busquets and Xavi and Iniesta when they were constantly closing down lanes. It seems like Garcia knows where he needs to be behind Busquets. And I think they support each other so, so well. And that's the same point with Pedri right in front of him. So now you have, even though that was Garcia playing as the right center back, you have this kind of almost a pseudo diagonal line from Garcia, Busquets, and Pedri, where everybody seems to always be in the right position when the ball is turned over. And when the ball is turned over, it's all about getting it back. It's all about getting it back as quickly as possible. But if you're not going to get it back on that very first pass or the second pass out of pressure that the opposition is trying to convert, then you have to make sure that you're already in the right spot to cut out a counterattack. And what I like about left foot be damned, because while Lenglet and Umtiti are the left-footed center backs, playing Piqué on the left allows him to use his, and I do say this, still superior defensive recognition of where he needs to be on the counterattack, allows him to use his abilities in the air. And now basically replacing what Lenglet was giving you as being the center back that was going to step two on the counterattacks, replacing that with Piqué is positive, because with Garcia, yes, he doesn't have the snuff out danger of Ronald Araujo, and he could be, yes, Garcia could have issues with the Mbappes of the world or with the Neymars of the world. And it is telling that all those players are on the same freaking three teams. So I'm not worried about that, because how many teams are, when is that really going to happen unless you're in the semifinal or the quarterfinal of the Champions League? But yes, he's going to have trouble with speedier forwards, but that's why you also have Ronald Araujo, who seems to be ready for prime time and playing at a top level. And so to have both Piqué, well, not by both, but all three of Araujo, Garcia, and Piqué, even though they're all three right-footed, I'm not too worried, because Garcia, he was 2 of 2 on his ground duels yesterday, only 1 of 3 on aerial duels. So expect that number basically the whole time. He always seems to anticipate well on the ground. And yeah, in the air, it's not so great. 76% passing accuracy, one key pass as well. It led to the second goal that De Jong was able to get assist on. Two block shots. His block shots, I thought, showed a lot of how he, as you said, he drifts into the position, and then he does have a quick enough first step to close down that space quickly. And then he had three clearances as well, 86 touches in the 83 minutes. I could not have been happy with Eric Garcia, and it makes a lot of sense to me with Piqué. Piqué has become a leader, but Eric Garcia is a leader. At 20 years old, you already see it. He is the reason why I thought Neto was good with the ball at his feet and playing out of pressure, and a lot of that is because of Eric Garcia. There was already an inherent trust with two guys that have never played together between Neto and Eric Garcia that gave Neto the green light to take chances, knowing that Barcelona were going to win those 50-50 balls back, and that the defensive setup was properly placed so that they could avoid the counterattacks. So I was very, very happy with the way that Eric Garcia not only fit into that system, but it seems like Koeman already knows how to get the best out of him. And I completely understand why he started. And I think Araujo should start the next one. That's okay. It's okay to rotate.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is. Ideally, there's going to be a lot of games. And ideally, you're going to need to rotate a little bit. You know, if you go, hopefully the La Liga games matter deep into the season, you know, and hopefully there's some sort of a Champions League run. And it doesn't have to be the semifinal or the final, but, you know, those games are going to add up. And, you know, the Copa del Rey, there's plenty of minutes. There's plenty of football to go around for these guys. And also, I mean, I think the season is an excellent opportunity to get an idea of, you know, I mean, Garcia looked fantastic yesterday. And so we know that. That's wonderful. You know, it's like that's a really positive data point. And so the more of those we can kind of put together, but it's also good to know, what do you have in Araujo, and just how does he fit? And, you know, I'll be interested too, especially when some of the young guys start getting like kind of mix and matched together, because you get a sense of when there's not sort of a veteran guiding hand. So if there's not a Piqué or a Busquets immediately on hand to tell them what to do, how do they kind of do that? And kind of to your point, I think Garcia is a good steady hand in that he seems to kind of think slowly. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, like he seems to kind of see the game in a, you know, relatively slowly, and kind of understand how it's unfolding. And he doesn't seem to get flustered. And so it's a very encouraging sign. I mean, I really enjoyed his work as well, very much.
Yeah, and so instead of being mean to people and saying like, hey, I remember if you were one of the ones that was down on Eric Garcia, I will say that there's an invitation on Eric Garcia Island or on the bandwagon. There is an invitation for everybody. So you can join me on the bandwagon. You already got a head start because you got to see him in the Liga in that first one, have a great match. But yeah, that is a hill that I'm willing to die on. For players, there are hills that I'm willing to die on. I don't have favorites, but there are hills I'm willing to die on. This is certainly a hill that I'm willing to die on. But I think too, for the big picture, the macro, it's a 4-2 win, good vibes. You're able to, again, begin the post-Messi era with some fanfare, and the fans certainly helped. And I think it might've been a different result even without those 20,000 fans when that free kick went in. And I think the fans kind of did kind of remind them. I mean, Piqué was, I know we kind of make it like the players are the players and the fans are the fans, but the players do feed off the crowd sometimes. And it's important for FC Barcelona players who are expected to do everything right all the time and be perfect, that they need sometimes the fans to kind of push them over the edge too. And that's good to see. And so the big macro picture about La Liga is that, not proven it yesterday, but I think it's kind of proven in the preseason, and we're seeing it yesterday, that there's a reason why Sid Lowe and Sam Marsden chose, and other pundits chose, the Barcelona to win La Liga this year. Why they think that it is a two-horse race between Atleti and Barca, with Real Madrid being in third. There's a reason why the pundits did that, is because Barca is deep. Barca has a system that they already understand, a second-year manager, a lot of young talent, still some veterans that do a good job. And it's interesting to me that, once again, while off the field, everything, because now we're going to transition talking about the Laporta press conference where we talked about money and it was really sad. So while everything off the field is still shrouded in darkness and pain, and when I say losses, I mean financial losses, everything on the field might be okay. And for a long time, the success on the field was papering over all the negativity off the field. And it seems like the negativity off the field has hit a breaking point where there's nothing, it's going to constantly be affecting what's happening on the field. But if the on the field product can win despite all the things that we now know very transparently about the finances, I mean, they can still win the Liga. If they can just, the players are paid to play. And I know that might be getting a free ride, but they're paid to play. And if they're going to win matches, this is a squad that's good enough to win the Liga and contend for the Liga. So don't start with the Champions League just yet, but at least the Liga, they've shown that they could be the best team in Spain. And if you're the best team in Spain, that gives you an opportunity to win the Champions League.
You've got a puncher's chance. Yeah. And I mean, I think these are two points that we've kind of, that you and I have talked about. And I think, you know, Messi leaving was just such a body blow, and it just took so much wind out of everybody's sails. But I think last time, you know, last week when you and I spoke, where we sort of landed, or it might've been 2 weeks ago when we were talking about, you know, running through the squad and what the squad should look like. You know, you do ultimately land on a place where it's brutal that Messi's gone, but this is not a team that's bereft of talent or completely, like, there are no bare cupboards. Sure, maybe you could use a little bit of, you know, extra depth, or, you know, a little bit more clinical finishing or whatever, but those are tweaks. But it's not a team that's totally bereft of talent. And so the notion of them, and I do think there's going to be a certain freedom for them playing, because, you know, Messi being gone, I think, and all the negativity around the, you know, kind of the finances that's just kind of very publicly spoken about all the time now, it's alleviated all the pressure. You know, I mean, there's just very little, almost nothing you can do. You know, no mistake that you make is going to, you know, make the situation markedly worse. And counterintuitively, I think it's going to allow them to play with a certain freedom that, because you never get to be the underdog as Barcelona. Like, Barcelona is never the plucky underdog. Like, they're never sort of counted out and, you know, things like that. So I think there is a certain freedom to that. And I think it's also sort of, I touched on it earlier, and I think I just sort of touched on it right now, was there's so much kind of negativity with the, you know, the retellings of the old Bartomeu stuff and the finances and this and that. There is no bad news that's going to make it worse. And I think that becomes very freeing as well, where you're just, okay, I'm gonna play the game. If, unfortunately, you know, God willing, we don't make any horrible mistakes and lose the game, but the stakes have been elevated outside of the club. Like, just the balance sheet stakes have gotten so big that no one, sort of the pitchforks aren't going to be out for us, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it makes our job a little harder, because we know that Nkuman, it keeps saying it incessantly, that he wants a center striker. He wants one of the top, I mean, they're really only about, what, 6-7 elite strikers in world football. And Barcelona don't have one of them, but there's 25 clubs that think that they deserve to have one of those seven. So that means that those seven cost a lot. And Lewandowski is even on the downward of his. I put Cristiano Ronaldo in that number, and he's obviously expensive and not a player that can be moved everywhere. So you're talking very, very few young number nines even that are available that for any financial thing. So for us, it hurts for content wise, because I mean, how many clicks do we get every summer, every winter, right? For this player is going to come to Barca. We're going to build the perfect squad. We're going to whatever, whatever, whatever. And now there's a full understanding that, and Laporta said in his press conference today that he's up for the job of trying to get rid of that debt, which we'll go over in a second. And he predicts the club can be back on its feet in 18 to 24 months. That's 2 years. I mean, he said in months, but that's 2 years basically that it's going to feel like a self-appointed transfer ban because Barcelona just won't be able to break the bank for anybody for almost 2 years. That's almost an admittance of that. And things could go well, things could go their way, but there's just so many problems behind the scenes that have to be done. So the good news is the players who are at the club are ideally because you'd hope that the club isn't going to get into worse shape, right? How could they get into worse shape? So in theory, the players who are at the club now are the ones who will be at the club. So get familiar with the players you have because those are the ones that could win for the next 2 years. And because there's so many young players that, you know, I talked about on Friday and we talk about every week, there's so many young players who can get better that if you get a bunch of those young players getting better, then this Barca squad that could win the Liga could be a team that improves. And so all the growth will have to come internally. And that means that we don't get to talk about Erling Haaland all the time. And we don't get to talk about the next young player that's now only 18 that's going to burst on the scene from in whatever division he comes from. And we're just going to be moving forward. So yeah, respond. And then I want to just...
What is actually really cool about that? And because I do agree with you. I mean, I don't think... I mean, certainly not big names. I mean, I don't think... And also, I mean, 18 to 24 months for the... We'll talk about the figures and sort of the level of the financial turmoil in a second. But, you know, 18 to 24 months is... I think that assumes a little bit that things go well, you know, like you need to catch some breaks to dig out of this hole within 2 years. But I mean, I think, you know, at least within 18 to 24 months, hopefully they'll just be in a position where they can start doing normal business again. But one kind of interesting thing and one very cool thing that I think could emerge from this, whether it's 2 years, 3 years, whatever, of no megastar signings. If this club, you know, if this side, whether it's this year, if they contend late or, you know, capture La Liga or they win the Copa del Rey or, you know, they even just go on a sort of just an uplifting Champions League quarterfinal run. I think what's going to happen over this 2 to 3 year period is you're going to get guys who, these guys are going to become the face of the Barca team that fought through this financial hell, essentially. And you will get the guys who perform the most and, you know, put in the biggest performances and the biggest moments or whatever, create those moments. Those dudes are going to be icons, you know, like they will be sort of local and kind of club legends in a way that,
well, it's Xavi, you
know, a lot of opportunities haven't existed for guys.
It's Xavi and Puyol in 2002, 2003, 2004. When they were making their debuts, Barcelona were finishing fifth, sixth in the Liga. They were in their, we were in our, that's the dark days in history before Frank Rijkaard and Ronaldinho shows up and they were able to get out of that mess. But the mess that Nunez left in his wake as Laporta came in 2003 was a bad, bad place. And it feels very similar to where the club is now. And that's not even financially, but just the, where the club's expectations are. And yet, unlike that time period where the talent just wasn't there to finish in the top three in the Liga, it's the talent is there to finish potentially in the top three. And the numbers here, Barcelona's gross debt risen to 1.3 billion, that's with a B. Then the club accounts show a loss of 481 million euros from last season. The revenue was 655 million coming in and outgoing, it was 1.36 billion. So he says that being Laporta, coronavirus only to blame for 91 million of the losses. So the excuse that was COVID, Juan Laporta is up front saying, I know other clubs are complaining about COVID, but we're not complaining about COVID. We're actually complaining about the things that my previous regime did. The things that Bartomeu did is why we're in this mess. And the numbers here that to break it down to make those numbers a little more understandable. To the initial debt of 617 million, there is 389 million on players to be added to that. So again, we start with 617 euros. 389 million on players, 90 million on litigation. On litigation, meaning all the different lawsuits and all the different zonal issues and blah, 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 blah. 79 million in advance television rights that were asked for and came in early. And then 56 million for the Espai Barça project that was already planned out in the budget and all those things. And that continued on. Because again, you have construction, you have all these different things that cannot be halted due to contracts being signed and they have to go forward with that regardless of losses. So in total, that's when we get to $1.35 billion. Now, the biggest issue is the one we keep going back to. Laporta said that Barca's wage bill, which had reached an unsustainable 103% of the club's income. He put that on the feet of the previous board, which obviously it's on them. Obviously, it is. 103% of the club's income on the wage bill. How is that mathematically possible, Emil, other than being impossible?
I mean, it really is living beyond your means. I mean, it's kind of it's living on the credit cards. And I don't know every sort of financial game that the previous regime played to somehow manage to kind of stack all these gargantuan salaries on the same club. Now, I know also the year or two prior to COVID, revenue was much higher. There was gate revenue, there was gate receipts, there was tourism in Barcelona and people buying Messi shirts and Barca scarves and all that stuff and going to tour the stadium and the museum and all that stuff. So I don't know how much exactly they've sort of lost from that. The fact that it's, I mean, obviously you don't, when you're a brand like Barcelona, I mean, I guess you don't factor in the global pandemic that might completely, sort of kneecap your business. But I mean, you're paying more in wages than is coming in. That assumes, that leaves no money to do anything else, like to pay the janitors and to paint, to paint a wall that might be damaged or stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely staggering. And
to me, my analogy would be, it's like me, I mean, here living in a pretty dense populated area, it'd be like me buying a big pickup truck where I'm going to have a hard time parking it. And how much actual stuff do I put in the bed of that truck, right? Like if I bought a $120,000 pickup truck, I know that I'm never going to make good on that pickup truck. I know that when the minute it leaves the lot, that the value of the truck is going to depreciate the minute I purchase it. So I'm not going to be able to resell it for that value, Coutinho. Then, am I ever going to get enough work out of that pickup truck where it's going to make sense to make that kind of investment? So, I mean, I can make that calculus just by going to the lot and going, this doesn't make any sense.
No.
Where I live and the situation that I'm in and financially what I should be spending on this doesn't make any sense. So the last two things here, so much of it goes on Bartomeu. You continue to put the ire on where that was. Well, and
that's always the question that I keep coming back to, is the sense of what was the plan? And I know to a large extent, there kind of wasn't one. It was essentially try to win each press release with something. But it was completely sort of indiscriminate spending.
Well, I think it's ineptitude to the position where Bartomeu, he got his money by, when you're on an airplane and there's that little, between the terminal and the plane, there's that little tube, that tunnel that you go.
Oh, the jetway. The jetway. Yeah.
That way. That is where money comes from. That is where Bartomeu's fortune is made. Right. So you're putting the faith of FC Barcelona, one of the largest brands in the world. I mean, just brands in the world. It's so recognizable. That crest, the crest, it's so recognizable. And you're putting that in charge of an individual whose entire expertise and understanding of the world is airplane tunnels.
And even his sporting background, when he was a Barca board member, his specialty was, I think, handball and
basketball.
Right. Yeah. So it's even in the realm of sports, this is not the sport that he knows best. It's generously, we'll say, in the top three, but wild.
Two things here. Yeah. I mean, Laporta had also mentioned it's only 8 million, we'll say, of the problem, but he said 8 million was paid for a South American scout. And then we went back and, thinking about the Americans that were brought in, Malcolm, Yuri Mina, Emerson, Mateus Fernandez, Marlon, Douglas, Ron Araujo, Gabriel Neves, Vitinho, Gustavo Mai, some of those names, the last three being Barca B, were surprising to me just to remember than the fees that were paid for them. So that whole list, and yes, it's like current present day, but Emerson and Ron Araujo, the two that are still left of the club, are the only ones that make any sense to me. I know Malcolm was fine. Malcolm was good, but Malcolm was also 40 million at a time when Barca had a bunch of other wingers. So, I mean, it was puzzling when he was even brought in at the time. And then I think he made good on what he was. But he just, again, it was a transfer that was puzzling because of the inflated prices of Brazilians.
Yep. Now, the only other one that I kind of, I was, and I mean, I think to a certain extent still am, or at least still kind of harbor positive feelings for, is I always liked Yerry Mina, but so he didn't, you know, I don't remember exactly what he cost, but he wasn't one of these like break the bank type signings. But yeah, I mean, that's, so they just paid the scout $8 million, right? And then for the privilege of then forking over all this other cash to, yeah, I mean, and I know, like you said, it's in the context of the numbers that we're talking about, sort of the big picture, it's like, you know, I'm almost relieved that it's only $8 million that, you know, that this hit is, but.
Wait, but then scouts were let go.
Oh, I know.
Weren't being paid. That's what then happened in January, when Barcelona restructured everything. And just as Bartomeu was on his way out, they got rid of a bunch of scouts.
Yeah.
And they still have to pay those contracts in full later on that were then terminated. So that didn't solve any problem. And so where quick Emil is Laporta, the one thing that he hasn't done properly, I think that people really got on him about, is the transparency. And now with players saying, said that he was just told about reducing his wages a few weeks ago. And obviously Laporta has said that it was, you know, from the start, there were things that had to happen. I'm getting the sense from hearing what Laporta is saying, and even from the players, that I know he said that Messi was, he was part of his campaign. He helped him get elected, but we do truly get the sense. And I think it's fair if a lot of Kool-Aid can't forgive Laporta for this, but there was no way, even if, again, I'm looking at the numbers here. There was no way, even if all of those players had taken salary reductions, right? Even if they had independently lowered the wage bill, it sounds like all the other depths even would have not allowed FC Barcelona, regardless of the Liga. It sounds like Barcelona's individual financial issues were not going to allow Messi to resign. And that was a decision that had to be made. And Laporta decided to kind of muddy the waters instead of be transparent and be the bad guy. And to say, because obviously what president says, I am going to choose the financial, even because that's the thing, fans, you can say the numbers and we said the numbers, but fans, they don't internalize it. And they don't care. It's not their money. They don't. Right. And you could say this about the former president, that it wasn't their money. It was the club's money. And that's why they made, they did. But because it's not the fans' money, if you're president and you go out and say, I have to choose us. We might go bankrupt or we might not, but I have to choose, you know, the financial future of the club over Lionel Messi. I know on paper, because he's gone, we said that, oh, you know, we would have supported that, but Kool-Aid would not have supported that. No way. Any president that says Lionel Messi has got to go, and yet you still have Coutinho and Umtiti and even Busquets and Roberto, right? That if those players are still around and Messi is gone, there's no way that anybody would have said you did enough. No way. Yes. And I think because Laporta wasn't more transparent, now he's getting the ire of, he's basically getting the response and result of as if he had done that from the beginning, right? Because he's been honest about what was truthfully going on.
Like the impression that I get of the whole thing, because I agree with you. I mean, when you now sort of, I understand that there was a certain element of, you know, kind of forensic accounting that had to be done after the elections. So, you know, Laporta won the election and it was after Barto and friends were out of the building that they brought in, I believe they even brought in external auditors, and they just had an internal audit team kind of fine tooth comb all the accounts and all the numbers and everything. So I understand to one point that these numbers are worse than what was assumed and anticipated during the election. So that's fair. That's reasonable. Fine. You didn't know. Okay. The only other thing that I can think of is, once you did know the extent of the problems, because I agree, once you know the extent of the problems and you know that under the law, under the rules, Lionel Messi can only take a 50% pay cut. And even when you do those numbers, that still leaves you needing to chop another $100 million in payroll. So you have to know that that's not going to work. I mean, unless you can find some sort of miracle plan to simultaneously both recoup transfer fees and just clear the decks of like Dembele, Coutinho, and Griezmann's wages, like that just simply wasn't going to happen. That was completely.
Part of that, though, we had the numbers. The numbers were made public.
So yeah.
Part of it is on us, even as Kool-Aids, for believing that there was still hope. And I know it's hard when your president says that there's still hope, and that's why people are frustrated with him. Because Dermot McCorgan of the Athletic there were people around the club who were just, who actually, it's their job. They're paid to look at those numbers, yeah, from a journalist perspective. And so he's putting it, like, I'm reading articles in Athletic saying, hey, everybody, Messi's, it's not going to work. And he was saying that for months and months and months. And it's not that, yes, I didn't see him. It's that Laporta was saying that it would work. And obviously we don't want to come to that reality before we have to. And so that's why,
exactly, I agree with that. And I think there's one last point. Yeah. And I think there's one last point, which is kind of, and I think this was where I allowed myself to sort of wishful think a little bit. And also just understanding the, was it Sid Lowe in Fear and Loathing in La Liga, Barca Real Madrid. Yeah. And so the description of Joan Laporta, I think there's one sentence where he's described as a lawyer by trade and a politician by nature. And so I think there was a sense, and I bought into it a little bit myself, that maybe there's a way that they're going to broker this and some kind of backroom deal, whether it's with La Liga, with creditors, with other clubs, as far as sort of wink, wink or handshake agreements to allow us to offload wages when we need to right now. We'll get you when we're in a healthier spot or something like that, or simply just some kind of a dispensation saying that, yes, the rules still apply, but it's Messi, it's Barcelona. We're not going to drive a wedge between into this relationship. That was the only thing that I thought, that there was some sort of, there was some sort of cavalry that would come over the mountain, and it seemed like it would. And then until it very much didn't.
Right. And I mean, and now we know that Laporta said it's potentially, and we're again going to try to believe this, that it's going to be 18 to 24 months until they're out of the woods. And so for Laporta, he almost set himself a timeline for saying, mm-hmm, hey, I'm not going to get a vote of no confidence. The Messi thing, it was obviously heartbreaking, but so much of that blame is pinned on those who came before me. Yeah. So if he survives this, and there's no vote of confidence, it seems like there's not going to be a vote of no confidence, because I think everybody understands that Bartomeu got them in that mess, and he's the one who got the
one. Who are you going to replace him with?
2 years to basically make good on it, and yeah, we'll see the club is in 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. Because also that's the thing. I mean, why would you bring a vote of no confidence against? I mean, unless you are a hardcore Bartomeu loyalist, why would you bring a vote of if your priority is in any way the actual sort of health and well-being of the club itself, be upset at Laporta. I understand he hasn't handled everything ideally. In some cases, he might have handled things poorly. But to kind of add more upheaval to a situation that desperately needs stability and sort of clear thinking. No, I mean, Laporta won the election. Laporta's the president. And for better and for worse, he's got the opportunity to sort of hack his way out of the rough here. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So I'll continue to support him because he's the president of FC Barcelona. That's the way this is. So I think that'll wrap it up. We've said all we have to say. We want to thank you for still sticking with us. We're on Twitter and Instagram, at the Barcelona Pod, close Facebook group, the Barcelona Podcast, ask the questions, get in the group. But then Patreon is how you help me to continue to make these shows. And I do appreciate all our new patrons over there. And on YouTube, I've been doing the five things I learned. It's not going to happen every match. It'll be a few hours after the match, but I'll see what I do as far as match review content. But it seems like people are enjoying those over there. So make sure you check that on the YouTube, give us a like, subscribe and all that stuff to help that keep going. So thanks so much for listening to the show. Until next time, we'll talk to you soon. Forza Barca.
Forza Barca.